Hey, everybody, welcome to the Shop Talk Show. This is our kind of travel edition. Both me and Dave are kind of on the road, but we brought our setups with us. If there's slightly lower audio quality, very sorry about that. But this show isn't about audio quality. It's about web dev stuff, as you know. This show is brought to you by Environments for Humans, who are promoting their 2013 In Control Conference in February in Orlando, Florida. Both me and Dave are going to be there. It's going to be awesome. Go to 2013.incontrolconference.com and lynda.com, proprietors of over 77,000 videos online for training stuff, from web design and dev stuff to just design in general. It really goes beyond the web. At lynda.com. Go to lynda.com/shoptalk for a free 1-week trial and check that out. But for now, let's kick things off. Meow. This week because of our travel itis.
All right, well, I'll just kick it up. Hello and welcome to episode 49 of the Shop Talk Show, a podcast all about web design development. I'm Dave Rupert. With me is Chris Coyer.
Hey, everybody.
And like Chris said, this is our kind of travel edition. We unfortunately do not have a soundboard this week, so we're soundboardless. So that's kind of the card we're dealt. Also, we're having a problem with the live stream. It doesn't work in Chrome. So thanks, Chrome, for nothing. There you go. All right. So, Chris, who's our special guest this week?
We have a longtime friend of mine. Our blogs are pretty much started at both the same time. You guys probably know him because he comes up in Google searches just as much as CSS Tricks does, I'm sure. We have David Walsh from the David Walsh blog. Hey, David, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me, guys. Good to be here.
Yes,
I'm glad you mentioned that, Chris, because David, your blog is it's like I kind of consider it this, you know, compendium of like edge case sort of stuff that like somebody you're gonna hit eventually, and when it's not covered on CSS Tricks, like your blog, it's yours, like you're there. Like Chris gets all the low hanging fruit, and yours is like the really awesome nitty gritty stuff.
Well, I like picking up Chris's scraps, I guess. Just kidding. I like to, I don't know, man. I just write about what comes to mind and how I get myself in trouble, and hopefully it helps other people avoid those problems for themselves.
Lately, it seems like you got the thing, like, I'm just going to like pick one simple like CSS property or something, or like, you know, one little ability that, or JavaScript API or something, and just explain it very simply with a demo always. So that's been good lately.
Awesome. Thanks.
Your latest post, or one of the latest, I guess, it was like five thing HTML APIs you didn't know about or something. Is that right?
Yeah, I had a couple of them that were like that.
Those were awesome. I didn't know the battery API was a thing, but it is.
Didn't that even make it into your talk,
Dave? Yeah, totally. I was just like, it came across and I was just like, whoa. This is handy. So,
yeah, there's a lot of stuff out there that we don't really know about. And if anything, I like bringing awareness to them. And of course, the API will change before it's actually implemented everywhere. But
it's non-spec. Some browsers
Like a fair amount of things change when you're one of the first people to blog or talk about them. So I always run into that thing where I look stupid a year later. But there's tons of APIs out there for us to try, and it's just fun to get your hands dirty before everybody else.
That's
yeah,
cool.
I mean, a classic use case for that one would be something like, so you can tell how full the battery is, right? And we all know that things like geolocation takes a bunch of battery power because it has to like ask outer space where you are, and that takes some battery power to do it. So if you wrote your JavaScript in such a way that your JavaScript, you know, you could either activate or deactivate your geolocation features, you could ask the battery, hey, are you pretty full? Cool, then do the geolocation stuff. Are you pretty close to empty? Well, then don't do it, just as a nicety for your users, right?
Yeah, absolutely. That's, you know, one of the best use cases for it. And there's a lot of other taxing stuff that websites can do if they're, you know, trying to do WebGL or other such things. So, you know, knowing where the battery is before you start up one of those monsters is really nice.
Yeah. Nice. Yeah, that's, and we're still in the early days of all that stuff, don't you think? These things are going to evolve over time. This is cutting edge. So you work for Mozilla, right?
Yes, sir.
So David Walsh, worker at Mozilla, and you're working on all kinds of different stuff, right? I saw a tweet the other day that's like, I committed to 4 different Mozilla projects in a day or something like that. So you're all over the place there.
Yeah, one of the most awesome parts about working at Mozilla is you can really pick and choose what you want to work on. I work primarily on the Mozilla Developer Network, MDN, that awesome documentation site that people always end up on. So that's my primary focus. But at the same time, I get to work on the Mozilla Marketplace if I want to. Recently, I've submitted some commits to Boot2Gecko, Mozilla's phone OS software coming up.
Ooh.
So, yeah, man, like you just get to work on pretty much whatever you want.
That's cool. So I guess like my question is how do you get to be one of these like kind of evangelists for a browser? I think that's the question people have all the time. Like, oh, I want to work for Mozilla, or I want to work for Chrome or Opera or something. But how do you get yourself into a position like that?
Well, I mean, The big thing that Mozilla has always promoted and centered itself around is openness and doing what's best for the web and basically all those warm and fuzzy feelings. So, you know, showing enthusiasm over the course of my blog, I guess, is what drew them to wanting to talk to me. And, I don't know how to explain it, but somehow I tricked them into hiring me, and I love going to work every day.
That's awesome. Yeah, no, that's cool. I one day somebody's gonna call me and mm-hmm. say, "Here's Dave, your time is worth $10." So, that's cool. And so, wait, I'm looking at your site, MooTools. Do you want
Dave? Dave has been a MooTools evangelist, essentially, not to mention core team member, for a lot of years now, right?
Yeah, yes, sir. MooTools for the win. It's awesome.
Ah, when's the last time you wrote a line of MooTools?
It's been a while, because when I first started with... Well, actually, when I redesigned my blog, I guess I did all that in MooTools. But, so over the past, like, over my career, I started out at a small shop in Madison where I did MooTools, and then I got hired by SitePen, who did Dojo, and now I work on MDN, which uses jQuery. So I'm sort of all over the board, but I still love MooTools. We still have good stuff coming, and I'm proud to say I'm part of that team.
That's cool. MooTools admittedly fell off my map just because I just decided to commit to jQuery, but suppose it's worth taking a look at. So,
is it still powerdavidwalshblog.com?
Yeah, absolutely.
Powerdavidwalsh.name.
Absolutely. Yep. Mm-hmm.
We were just talking about the other week about Prototype and how somebody wrote in basically like confused why Prototype even still exists, because it just seems like so antiquated or whatever, and the world has just kind of moved on from Prototype. And then there was Sam Stevenson had a blog post of, who is its creator, who works for 37 Signals, about how, like, I don't know, he took it a little personally for a little while, not our radio program, but just this, like, the you know, how short-lived Prototype was or whatever, that it's not well-regarded anymore. And then he was like, you know what, screw that. You know, this was just a time and place thing, and there's no reason to take, you know, people's opinions about software that seriously. It's just part of your story as a developer. I'm not sure if I have all those details correct, but is MooTools destined to become Prototype, or is it just going to live on forever? I mean, I know you're a little biased in this. You love MooTools, but for real, in your heart of hearts, is it a long time project? It's going to be around 2 years from now.
Heart of hearts. It will. the MooTools project will be around. The next iteration of it is being worked on, and instead of it being one big chunk library like jQuery has been, and like basically all the frameworks have been, all of the JavaScript stuff is moving sort of toward modules instead of these huge JavaScript files. So MooTools is going to become even more modular. It's going to work on both the server and client sides, and actually MooTools has for quite a while. So it's not going anywhere.
Okay, cool. I just wanted kind of the background of how that works. It's kind of interesting that it's server side a bowl, like Node or whatever, or just like the syntax of it is going to be server side ready. I mean, I don't even know, hardly know what that means.
Well, if you write your JavaScript in a modular format like AMD or CommonJS, it will work in Node and it will work in the browser.
Huh. Cool.
So it's sticking around. It's sticking around. You don't get to write it at work, but you can still keep up on it anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. And Mozilla isn't baked into, or it doesn't have a vested interest in any JavaScript framework, really. So if I wanted to use it on the redesign of MDN, I could.
Interesting.
So take that, Coyer.
way back in the day, it must be 4 years ago or something, we used to be like little moderators or something for this weird site called DZone, which is still around apparently, and literally looks exactly the same as it did 4 years ago. I'm sure some Shop Talk Dull listeners know about it, but holy man, that was weird.
Yeah, that was fun. That was in our growing pains days.
Yeah.
Moving on.
Yeah, I wonder what they do. I don't even want to talk about it. Anyway, another thing we went through together just randomly as we're introducing our guest, David Walsh, if you're just joining us, of Mozilla and davidwalsh.name, wasn't this year, it was last year, so it was in 2011, I guess. We kind of both found out fairly near each other that our domain names were stolen from us. And I thought of you recently because I was watching TV, some football game, and there's a freaking 1&1.com commercial on TV. Man. And I was like, I hate you. I think we probably talked about this before, but was 1&1 involved somehow in yours? Didn't they have to steal it back from 1&1 or something? How did yours go down?
Yeah, so the way that it worked out is it was taken from GoDaddy, moved to name.com, then moved to 1&1. And 1&1 just wasn't helpful at all. And, so luckily name.com did some like behind the scenes James Bond stuff to actually to get in touch with the thief who then claimed a friend did it. And name.com helped me actually take it away from 1&1, or I should say pull it back from 1&1, because there's a window that domain registrars have to do that. And so luckily I got my domain name back, but I know that some people weren't so lucky.
Well, that was the problem. You were lucky in that 1&1, anybody else who had 1&1 involved with their domain theft, and if people have no idea what we're talking about, literally someone was able to like somehow do some crazy hacking stuff, and none of us have ever quite figured out exactly how they did it, which transferred their domain away from our ownership to some thieves' ownership. It was a huge, huge problem. Anybody else, and they would transfer them to different hosts. So there was no one host we could blame because the starting registrar and the ending registrar was different in almost every case. Mine started on GoDaddy, as did David's, but not everybody did. And it went to name.com and then 1&1. And anybody else where 1&1 was part of the chain, that's where the chain stopped, because 1&1 is so incredibly unhelpful at getting these back for people. So Tanaka, which I'm sure some of you are aware of, had a really good blog with cool tutorials and stuff on it, is done, gone, dead to this day. Gone. Tragic. What a nice guy. Did not deserve that in any way because his was on 1&1 and they just wouldn't help. So you are a bad company, 1&1. Boo on you. Never allowed to sponsor Shop Talk Show. Take your TV ads off. I'm sick of looking at them. Anyway, yeah, name.com was really cool to David, and that was very worth what they did because David's, you know, when you do right by David, you're going to hear about it, man. Yeah, just constantly shoveling love on them.
Absolutely. I mean, the thing that I always remind people with that situation was that name.com, I know, spent a ton of time trying to get my domain name back, and I had never spent a dollar with them. Right. I wasn't a customer. They were just like the intermediary, but they went to the wall for me, and they deserve every bit of business that like me mentioning them gets them. It's a really great company.
Yeah, that's good. There's some free advertising for you. Name.com. They do right by smaller man. Anyway, so we all know. Okay, David Walsh, he's our guest. You all know about his whole life now. Like soccer, yada yada.
Yep.
I want to mention at the top of the show, before we get into the meat and potatoes of Shop Talk Show, the question and answer area of two, we're going to skip drama.
No, I want to say that no real drama. It's Christmas. Holidays are slow on drama, I think.
Oh, yeah, but let's, you know, I'm sure you all have your own family drama. Let's stick.
Uncle. I guess that's me, though.
There are shirts for Shop Talk Show now. They're just going to be up forever, so no rush. If you're broke after Christmas, that's okay. But if your grandma gave you an envelope with some money in it and you just have no idea where to spend it, go to shoptalkshow.com/store, and there are shirts available for you in there to check out. It's just our logo on a gray shirt. It's kind of faded. It looks like you've owned it for 20 years. By the time you get it, they're pretty cool. I felt like mentioning at the top of the show. Instead of at the bottom when I did last week. And I work on an app called CodePen, as some of you know, codepen.io. And we had a big release last week, and we now have CodePen Pro accounts that have all kinds of cool features in it, like being able to pair program when you're trying to figure out a problem with your friend. You can open up an editor, share that URL with your friend, and you can both type together, kind of like you can type together in like a Google Docs or whatever, but this is a coding environment. A syntax highlighting and a live preview and all that stuff. That's just one of the many cool features on CodePen Pro. And that's, you know, it's came across kind of like an ad, and I guess it is. It's the app that I work on. We have pro plans now, so dang it, check it out. It's cool.
Nice ad, bro. I'm trying to find out. Somebody tweeted out a picture of them. Lenny Siravong tweeted out a picture of him in the Shop Talk Show shirt. It looks good.
Yeah.
Awesome. Nice. Anyway, looking good.
Doug Niners in our chat room. Thanks for joining us after Christmas. Doug, he tweeted him wearing, and his brother wearing both at Christmas, wearing CSS Tricks hoodies.
Whoa.
So those are available too, but I'm not going to do an ad for those.
No, you should, man. Those t-shirts, sweatshirts are awesome. I love mine. Yeah. Or mine down to Brazil.
No, awesome, really.
Yep. CSS Tricks has a huge presence in Brazil now.
Grassroots. That's good. Well, let's kick it off and get into some questions here.
Yeah, you do this first one.
All right, our first question is from Steve. Steve writes in and says, I'm wondering if I should be using relative measurements, like the M unit, for absolutely everything, including padding. I read recently that not using pixels for padding can actually cause some problems. And because he wrote out, I love that. And because that's one of the few parts of my site not set with relative measurements, I'm kind of hoping I don't need to change the padding. So, David, do you have any thoughts on using M's for everything? Are you in that camp?
I am not brave enough to use M's for everything at all. I still like sticking to pixel-based stuff when I can and sort of sprinkling in some media queries for common devices, but I don't know that I would be brave enough to use M's for everything. One of the cool things, though, and I did a blog post about it recently, was CSS Calc, which allows you to say, I want something to be X percentage wide or, you know, X percentage in pixel value, minus a pixel value, which sort of allows you to blend those two things together. So I guess, you know, that's one thing to look at in the way that I would go.
I do a little bit of M-based. I feel like if you're setting your font size in M, which is the most common use case for M, and you're probably setting your line height in a unitless value, so it's just a which is essentially M then, because it's just a multiplier of whatever the font size is, then it kind of makes sense that the like margin bottom on the paragraph element, for example, would also be an M, just so that you're kind of keeping the everything that's in charge of spacing typography out would be an M. And then it's like, if you're following that logic, like why not then have the padding of the container around that text be set in M? So all those things are kind of related and bound to each other. That would be the idea, you know, that if Steve is reading about this and curious about it, he probably read some article that had, you know, was talking about those types of things. Like, and I feel like people that are stuck on pixels, not that that's necessarily bad, or the pixels is an inappropriate thing to use, because it's perfectly fine, really. It's just that they have this thing in their brain, I think, that they think pixels is more like sturdy, or they understand what one pixel represents.
Yeah,
in a way that they don't understand what 1M represents. But if you can loosen yourself away from that and kind of understand that these are arbitrary things anyway, it is possible to understand what an M is. These are all kind of arbitrary measurements anyway, that there's nothing wrong with setting your paddings and stuff with M's. And in fact, there are a few advantages to it, in that if you go with a structure where perhaps you're decreasing the font size for a smaller screen, because you have like, you know, you have like 18, you know, what would be the equivalent to 18 pixel text on large screens, and you want to shrink that down to 14 on small screens. If you just do that through a media query and changing that font size on the body, you can also squeeze in that. As soon as that font size changes on the body, those paddings squeeze in a little bit too. As the text gets smaller, that padding gets smaller, which can feel, it's kind of cool. It's like building your own zoom effect in a way.
Yeah. For me, I think it creates kind of this kind of tightly coupled, but in a good way, kind of typographic system for padding and stuff. But I mean, you don't have to switch over to M's. I just find them way more convenient personally. That's my IMHO.
David said he doesn't feel brave enough. Is that what makes you decide that it needs bravery to do that?
Just ensuring that items that you have floated next to each other, just keeping your grid in order without having wrap around.
Yeah.
I feel like there's a certain level of control that you end up missing, but that's why you're the CSS trickster, Chris.
I suppose. I can see how that would be weird if you're like, I want this container to be, you know, 40 M's wide. Like, how much is left in the parent container? It's not 60 M's. It's just, you don't really use it for things like that. Anyway, Steve, good luck. I don't think there's a right or wrong answer to it. Let's just give it a shot. See if you like it. There's definitely not a right or wrong answer to this. We have a question from Adam Davidson. Adam Davidson. And he's asking, in short, Google Analytics or StatCounter? I use both on my personal sites, and I find that I get very different results. I appreciate that Google Analytics uses JavaScript, so it may not always be accurate. For example, if someone has JavaScript turned off, they won't get measured on Google Analytics. And he doesn't say what StatCounter uses, but theoretically they could use an image with a little, you know, and then they read server logs for the requests of that image or whatever. There's ways around the JavaScript thing for sure. But he says, often I find that Google Analytics has more hits than StatCounter, which makes the JS argument invalid. Let me give you an example of a recently launched site. So he says in the text here that he gets more hits with Google Analytics, and then gives us some statistics, which I'm not going to read out loud. But in these statistics, Google Analytics has about a third of what StatCounter is reporting. So it's the, kind of the opposite of what he said. Google Analytics is reporting one third of the number of visitors that StatCounter is, which is a drastic, very drastic difference. So I can see how he might be confused on like which one of these is more accurate. He goes on to say, As you can see, the difference is quite significant. This is based on a small site. I would imagine the bigger the site, the bigger the discrepancy and the difference. Do you know why this difference exists, and which service should I be presenting to my clients? I think it would be confusing to them to give them both. So, there's a lot of good questions in here. Should you be using multiple analytics things, or is one of them enough? Or let's start there, perhaps. Do you, like on DavidWalsh.name, do you just use Google Analytics, or do you use multiple things?
I just use Google Analytics, and I don't have a great reason for that, except for that I've always used it. It's easy to pull information. And the reason why I think that Google Analytics is good is it presents things in a very, presentable way for a client. You can also set up emails to the client, which is something that I used to do, where you send them the weekly report of visits and what was popular and such. And you can use that. But I wouldn't disparage anybody from using multiple services. And I guess it would just take some time to figure out which one of those two things or which one of those two services you believe are giving you the correct data. It's also like really feature-based too, because I've never used that counter, but I don't know if you can set up tracking whereby you try and keep the person that comes into the site on a path and track how they get to your checkout page or if they get to your checkout page. So I guess the other thing that you would need to find out is what features each one would give you and which ones you actually need.
True. That's tough. I like that Google Analytics is very robustly featured. So if there's stuff that you're trapping that you might not even know that you need, that later you'll have it because it's tracking it. It's pretty cool. I just found out that Google Analytics has a really cool live dashboard. Have you guys seen that, where it shows you like how many people are on your site right now?
Yeah, oh, no. It's tough to find, but it exists. It's pretty
cool.
Yeah,
you gotta go. I can explain it pretty quickly, but it wouldn't mean anything over the radio. But I have found like a way to get to it quickly. It's weirdly buried. I agree, but it is totally awesome.
So we used on the many faces of at Paravel, we used Mint, which is from Sean Inman. It's like a PHP-based kind of, you host your own stats. You like basically have your own database and, you know, you're filling it with logs and stuff like that. It was really cool, but we'd noticed a huge discrepancy between that and Google Analytics. And I think we trusted the Mint ones because it was more real time. It was a little more accurate. It wasn't, you know, the aggregate stats or whatever, but I guess my point is I feel like you need to kind of just take an average of, if you're doing multiple stats, I think you need to take an average. And then what really matters is kind of relative. Like, is your traffic up or down? Is it, you know, is it going up or is it going down? Is it going, you know, are people finding that value, that content valuable or not? So maybe that helps. I don't know.
It's hard to argue with ones that parse server logs, you know, because that's as accurate as it gets. You know, your server distributed these files. It looks at them to decide how many visitors you had. That's pretty robust.
Doug Niner, that guy, he's in the chat. He's saying Google Analytics doesn't track spiders.
That may have a difference.
So yeah. That would have a difference. But I don't know if it would have like a 3x difference. That's where it gets kind
of, that's where all of my thinking is being based right here. That is a difference of 3x is huge. And I'm saying there's something else going on there. One, it could be that you're looking at the wrong number. And I don't, you know, I'm not trying to accuse you of anything, Dave, Adam, but it may be the case that there's a stat often called visitors or unique visitors or truly unique visitors. And then there's page views. And there, a lot of times there are 2x or 3x different values because they're, you know, just one visitor might view multiple pages, but the multiple pages they visit only count towards one for a unique visitor. Those numbers seem like you might be looking at those two different things. You're looking at stat counter page views in Google Analytics, unique visitors, possibly. Another one might be that it's installed incorrectly, possibly. You have stat counter somehow installed on more pages of your site, or in some different way. They may not be installed exactly perfectly on your site. I don't know. Maybe it's something to look at. Yeah.
I don't know if bots like keep the same session either.
So they might just, it might be like 100 bots or something coming from a different
computer. Sounds like if anybody has a built-in spider removal from the stats, because it absolutely doesn't matter, you know, it would be Google Analytics, and I could see. Anyway.
Back in the day, I used we're going overboard on this. Back in the day, I used StatCounter, and I used to think I was getting like mega hits, and I was like, yeah, dude. But it turned out it was just like one image getting stolen a whole bunch. So it was like somebody just hot linking an image from my site. So it was just, I thought I was getting all this traffic, but it was really just some forum more popular than my website was stealing my traffic, my bandwidth. So there you go.
Yeah, great.
Something to think about.
The chat room also mentioned gauges, which is at git.gauge, GAUG.ES. You know, one of those fancy domain names, which looks like a very nicely designed set of analytics software. Costs money, though. I wonder how they try and compete with Google Analytics. Maybe it's just
they have more real time, and it's owned by GitHub now. So
is this one of those ordered list things?
Yeah, it's an ordered list.
Oh, cool. Wow, those guys are good. Anyway, let's move on.
All right.
Let's do a sponsor. It's been a bunch of minutes. Lynda.com is one of our sponsors. Like I said at the top of the show, 77,000 videos plus in their library. That is a friggin' ton of videos. They're all training-style videos. I have a course on there. I have a course on how to theme WordPress, kind of like a course in showing you what the whole workflow is like. So we literally start with nothing, and we Photoshop up a theme and then break it into HTML and CSS and then move it over into a WordPress theme. And it just has all the different steps of doing that. So some of those 77,000 videos are my WordPress theme, but there's so many more things in that. So there's web stuff that you guys might be interested in because you're listening to a web show, like programming and design and stuff. But then it goes way outside of that. There's courses on business and audio and video and 3D stuff. You know, there's recent courses on version control and pre-processing. So tons of stuff. Go to lynda.com/shoptalk. And that's it'll kind of redirect so that, you know, it gives us a, I don't know, it uses Google Analytics and tracks the hit. So they know that we're sending traffic to them, which is useful to me and Dave. And you get 7 days for free if you go use that URL. If you want to just check it out. Watch a course quick and get out.
That's insane. 7 days for free. Just, wow.
For free. Okay. Cool. Aaron Taylor. I'm a web designer that still uses FTP. Whilst I would consider myself to be pretty up to speed in most areas of the web world, I have not yet made the transition to adopting a Git workflow. I understand some of the benefits and can appreciate this workflow on large sites. However, is this not overkill for a simple web designer working on small, manageable sites? I'm sure a lot of people have this feeling about them. I kind of put it in here because I'm interested in, number one, I almost surely, David, when he works on Mozilla sites, are highly version controlled, and they have a very specific workflow that he follows. Is that right?
Yes, sir.
Is it Git?
It is Git, and it's GitHub, yep.
Git and GitHub, but they're private, I'm sure, a lot of this stuff.
No. Mozilla is open, everything, so.
Even your marketplace is as a open GitHub repository?
Yes, sir.
Is it really? That's amazing.
Yeah, github.com/Mozilla/Zamboni.
I'm currently forking and pointing the payment gateway to...
Obviously, some of those security details are not based on the GitHub stuff, but yeah, Mozilla Developer Network that I work on every day is also on GitHub.
Yeah, But it's also a wiki, so that's kind of a, isn't it, kind of? Because you don't like version control that, like, the page for border radius is just editable right from the web.
Right, but we do keep revisions, so we could go back and get it, but it's not within the GitHub repository. It's within a MySQL database.
Which is just another kind of version. It's another version of version control.
Right.
Okay, but then if you put on davidwalsh.name, is that version control? Do you use Git on that as well, or do you just rock and roll, rolling through FTP?
Against my better judgment, I don't version control it. I just use FTP for that. But
so you're the perfect person to ask about this question. Aaron Taylor is asking about you, essentially. He's like, I understand Git. I understand on large project that's the way that you should do it, but isn't it just better to just not use this fancy workflow on smaller sites? Or what can you expand on your saying of against my better judgment?
Right, so I really should be using Git. However, I prefer to spend time writing articles and sort of tinkering more than working with process on my own stuff. The one sort of disadvantage he's at with his question is that he's using stuff, or he's using just FTP and no version control for a client, which sort of scares me, but because it's my own site, I can say, well, screw it. If something happens, I can, you know, figure it out. But it all depends also on how you bill. Because more process means more time spent, and that means more billing. So it's really up to you as to how much you charge and if version control should be part of that. I would say version control as much as you possibly can, but if there just isn't the time for it, then don't.
Well, that sounds pretty pragmatic. I just do everything now. Our little shop talk show is version controlled. All my stuff is. Just because it's more, it's not, the advantage isn't just this ethereal, oh, version control is always better. It's this magical thing that makes all workflows better. It's more than that. It's number one, it's about working locally. So if you should probably, you know, it's just easier to work on sites that you have and can run solely on your own machine. It means you can work offline. It means it's faster development because it's not making web requests out to the world. They're just all happening internally. There's working locally has all this slew of advantages to it. And if you're working locally, you need to get it from locally to the site, which means version control helps you do that anyway. So it just becomes this part of this step of working locally. If you're working locally, that means you can use preprocessors a lot easier because you just can compile and commit only preprocessed stuff. So it's all this stuff becomes linked to each other. You know, working on teams, you know, Aaron says, you know, you're working on these little tiny things. Well, if you have one other employee who starts working with you on these client sites, all of a sudden it starts to be a lot more compelling to use version control because you can kind of keep up to date on each other's, check out each other's commits and see who's working on what. And what if, you know, if you're all on this FTP thing and you both wake up at 1 a.m. because you have this idea of something you're going to do and you both have the index.php file open and save over each other, there's no way to get back. There's just no, you're just writing over each other's changes, and that's the kind of thing that, you know, makes any kind of developer cringe, is this system where losses are a possibility. And that's one of the things that it prevents. So there's just a slew of reasons to use version control and adopt a more working locally kind of workflow. So that's the idea. And don't think of Git as, Git really isn't about deployment. That's kind of a whole separate issue. Version controlling is one thing. And then how you get files from your version control repository to your live website is another thing. They're often thought of together because they're so related. But just for the radio audience, Git isn't a deployment tool. It is just a version control tool. What else?
I think the best thing you could do, you're kind of have a thing on like the modern web developer workflow, or what, that's a talk you have right now, mm-hmm. Chris, but I think just in general, like, we need to kind of, as a whole, kind of stop using FTP as an editing tool, and it's only just a deployment tool. And if a robot's doing that, that's probably better. So, better than you, who can probably forget to upload a file or something like that, or you end up deleting a whole directory just to upload one, you know, swap out one change or something. So, anyway, yeah,
just do it live, man.
Oh yeah,
just wing it.
No, I know. For the longest time, I was like, well, if this page goes white, only a few people will see it. You know.
Oh god, CodePen was a little white for a good 5-10 minutes today. There. Whoops.
No biggie.
I committed and I prevented this one. I wonder if it was my fault, actually. Crap, it could have been. Somebody's like, oh, you're mid-ot, you know, like ampersand, mid-ot, or anything.
Oh, yeah.
Amp, you know, what am I talking about? Just Unicode characters, essentially, named entities. We had that in our page titles, and it was like escaping twice or whatever, so it would say the named entity in the title, and I was like, oh crap. I'm like, oh, you know what? You know, like in HTML, you hardly even need to use named entities anymore. You can just throw Unicode right in HTML as long as you're using like UTF-8 or whatever. But Rails does not love that. So don't put Unicode into, you know, the straight up Unicode characters into your Rails files. Doesn't like that. My fault. Sorry.
White page. Awesome. Okay, so let's go to the next question. This one's from Matt. He's asking about your hands. What strategies do you guys use to avoid symptoms of carpal tunnel and tendonitis? I often find myself suffering from stiffness throughout the day and evening, and it doesn't take a doctor to confirm that it's linked to all-day coding. Stretching my arms throughout the day helps some, but I was wondering if a better solution exists. Any advice would be helpful, as I'm sure you guys have run into this in your coding careers. Thanks.
Well, Chris, you had an issue like that, right?
Oh, I did. I just actually found a picture recently of where I was living out in Portland, Oregon, and I had a wrist brace on, and I was like, I used to wear that all the time. Because it was really bad for like a year when I lived there. I could barely type. I had to limit how much I could work and stuff, and it would just really hurt really bad. And honestly, all I did was switch to using a trackball full time. So I have this, you know, the Kensington Expert mouse, which I love, and I was proficient at before because I used to use it as a job where all I would do was cut clipping paths on images. Anyway, it's good for that. And I switched to the Microsoft Ergonomic 4000 or whatever. It's one of those annoyingly huge keyboards with the like river down the middle where it splits the keys in half and they're kind of angled. And it's literally gone, and I never have any pain anymore, and it solved my entire problem. So it was not carpal tunnel. I think I have this book that is in like huge red letters with an exclamation point at the end of it that says, "It's not carpal tunnel syndrome." And it's about how people kind of misinterpret that a lot, and it's usually not carpal tunnel. It's usually RSI, repetitive stress injury, especially for us nerds who do a lot of typing and stuff and clickins. So, you know, people, doctors even can treat carpal tunnel a lot when that's not really the problem. Anyway, that's it. Have you ever had it, Dave?
No, I haven't. I've never had any problems, but I wear
you play too much soccer.
Yeah, I wear healthy. Two bowling braces. Just to make sure. No, just kidding. I've never had that problem, but I've also gotten into the habit of just getting up and walking away at least once an hour. Like go to the water cooler, go to the fridge, go wherever, and get away from the keyboard. And I bet that would help out quite a bit.
Yeah. Isn't there some nice apps for that kind of thing? Like time out, get up and walk around.
Oh, there could be. Yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there are.
Come on, chat room.
I dealt with stiffness a lot for, like my hands would like come away like crampy, you know? which I assume is like general, everyone has that. But two things that helped me, the Apple keyboards with like the low keys, just because it's not, you know, it's less movement, you know, it's kind of really swift key movements that helped me, less resistance, like finding the right keyboard. And then I switched from a mouse to a trackpad, and this wouldn't work if you're a designer and you're, you know, getting down to like 6,400 pixels or 64,000% or whatever it is. The trackpad works really well if you're like just a developer and you need the mouse every like 10 minutes. Using a trackpad, like that magic trackpad thing, that's helped out too, because now I can kind of just really dumbly, I'm not like in that mouse grip, the claw, I like to call it. I think the claw actually stressed out my hand the most, the mouse claw. So yeah, there you go. That's my advice.
All I had was that the equipment really does matter.
Yep. I knew this. I know this guy. There's this guy in Austin who has like the flip up keyboard. Have you seen that? It's like a keyboard, and then the middle splits apart and it goes vertical. So it's like got two walls, if you can imagine that. And like, so he types like vertically. Like,
oh, really?
It's cool. What? It's extreme. I'll try and find an image. You guys just keep talking.
Okay, that's good. Yeah. I am at home right now. I'm in Madison, by the way, where David, me and are in the same, in Verona, technically, small town outside of Madison, in the country, looking at our snowy winter wonderland out my door. My mom got a Christmas puppy. Oh,
I saw that.
In nine chat, super cute, little Westie. What I was going to say is I don't have my fancy keyboard, and I can tell. If I go too many days in a row without my fancy keyboard, starts to hurt. I can feel it right now. I'm rubbing my fingers because it hurts. Oh, poor me. Let me do another sponsor while Dave is Googling things.
No, they posted it in the chat room. It's awesome.
Oh, did they? I have to look at it even though I can't describe it over there. Holy cow. Okay, it's weirder than you think, people on the radio.
That is mental.
Yeah.
It looks kind of amazing, though. I can't even describe it. It's too weird. Okay.
It's Transformers plus keyboard. Go ahead.
Go to the URL 2013.incontrolconference.com. They're our lovely sponsor, sponsoring this week again, Environments for Humans, February 17th through 19th. They're still selling early bird tickets. So they're $7.99 to go to this in-person conference in Florida. It's at an awesome hotel. The where you stay is the same as the conference, which I love. Both me and Dave are going to be speaking at it with other great speakers. So it's a three-day thing, workshops and then 2 days of speaking. Carl Smith is keynoting it. Oh, whatever, Carl. You better bring the juice if you think you can keynote this. Josh Clark, Megan Fisher, Brad Foss, Zoe Gillenwater, a bunch of people you'll recognize from being past guests on the show. Anyway, it's going to be awesome. I love Orlando. I really do, honestly. I used to live in Tampa, and I just, you'd think, like, why is Orlando even a city? This entire state has more beach line than anywhere in the world. Or I don't know. You know what I'm talking about. It's this incredible. There's beaches all the way around this entire state of Florida. And then they're like, let's make a really big city right in the middle where it just makes no geographical sense for a city to be. And we'll put all this stuff there, like Disneyland and stuff. Or is World there? I think it's Disney World. Anyway, it's kind of a nice town despite its weird geography, you know, the weird choice of where it is as a city. And there's a lot more to it. You can go there and not even glimpse Disney World if you want. I'm sure the people that live there are well aware that it's a city unto itself. But anyway, I quite like the actual city part of Orlando. Anyway, that's where it is. It's in a nice hotel. There's lots of awesome speakers there. It's one of my favorite conferences of the year. In Control, February 17th through 19th. Use the coupon code ShopTalkShow for $100 off even the early bird. You can go for it on the cheap. It's going to be nice, especially like, for those of us looking out our window at huge snowstorm things. No snow. No such thing as snow in Orlando.
You like swamps? You like cities built on swamps? Come to Orlando. Nah, it's going to be so much fun. I'm already excited about it. So Cool. Lovely to see you there. All right. Next question. Let's see. I'm looking around. I'm going to go. Brian Street wrote in. He said, are you familiar with any examples of responsive e-commerce? Most responsive sites used as an example center around content, but don't appear to have a shopping cart with products, product configuration, etc. I added a letter into the word etc. David, do you do a lot of responsive stuff or not much?
Not with regard to e-commerce, I guess. Unfortunately,
the question is really like complicated. Can you give me, you know, a lot of responsive designs are just a blog, right? And they're like, oh, I just squished the main content area down. Done.
Right.
But complexity is another thing. Is some of the, but you do, you, I mean, your site is in a way responsive, isn't it? I haven't looked, but I'm sure you've worked with media queries and stuff.
Yeah, generally I just use media queries. So you end up starting with common devices and then moving toward, I guess, edge cases, depending on what you can see within your analytics.
Mm-hmm.
But you do this need to keep a general strategy of structure.
Design on this.
Thank
it's
you,
awesome,
sir.
Actually, because it collapses the menu into a drop-down, which you need for responsive design, because you have way too much navigation, and not too much, but you just have a lot of it on the main site. And then the sidebar snaps away. I would make those headlines a little smaller on the mobile. They stay the same size all the way down. But other than that,
well,
you did
thanks,
a fabulous
man.
Job. let's see. You know, I when I read this question, I was like, oh, I'm going to go and check out a couple sites that I are super nice design. I'm sure they're responsive. I almost like equate nice with responsive these days, because chances are if it's a nice looking site, it's probably responsive. And I was like disappointed. I'm not even going to name them, because it's not that it's rude. It's just that I was like, oh, bummer, not responsive. But you know, one that is, I'm going to check it one last time.
An e-commerce site is actually really hard to make responsive, especially if you're trying to use an existing open source tool.
Yeah, if you're building it like on Magento, good luck. Well, I don't mean to pick them out specifically, but mostly because the way they work is they have, you know, it's like fill up the left column, fill up the center column, fill up the right column, you know. That's kind of how those tools are designed, like their layout system, their template system. So you need like kind of a home bake system, whether that's like WooCommerce, somebody mentioned in the chat room, or it's like LemonStand, something easily themable, you know. You're gonna need that to do that. I want to point out the pixel workers.
That's what I was gonna do.
That's who you're gonna do. Sorry, dude, I stole your thunder. But they they've sponsored the show in the past, but they have a t-shirt. They sell t-shirts and all kinds, and they do a really good job at doing responsive e-commerce. I think they set the bar, because
it's so good.
Getting the checkout flows and everything is pretty tough. And they used to be on Shopify. I'm not sure what they're on right now. But Shopify will eventually bounce you out to their payment page, which is probably not responsive. But for the most part, like, they kept it. They did it really well. So, yeah.
I think it transcends technology. The reason that e-commerce is hard is because there's just more stuff that needs to go on any given page than does a blog article. You need a picture. You need multiple views of that product. You need a title and a subtitle and description and price and options and an add to cart button and a little form. And, you know, and then all the stuff that a blog article has anyway, like a header and navigation and a footer and where the shopping cart goes. And like, there's just so much stuff that you have to pack in to an e-commerce design that it's challenging to figure out exactly where to put what and have it still be this workable experience on any size screen. It's almost one of those things where it's like responsive design is hard to pull off because there is so much different stuff, and it would be kind of easier if there was different code bases that you could work from. But this sets the bar because it is so good. I wish they liked Dave jokes more. I think they pulled out because they didn't like your jokes, Dave.
Oh, yeah. Maybe my jokes. Oh, well.
We haven't done a joke in a while.
No, I need to work on that. I'll I'll start writing. Oh, that's good.
I think that if you have the ability to create your own e-commerce site, I think that, you know, from scratch, the design aspect should be good, but when you're trying to work within the framework of something that's already created, you, like Dave said, your work is really cut out for you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Because there's so much, you know, it could just be in one big table or, you know, there's probably a table somewhere. I know we dealt with that when we were working on Type Foundry, which sells fonts. Because it just, there's just enough stuff that, because it's tabular data, you know, like what's in your cart, you know? But then how do you break that out? Do you do, you know, it's tough. It's genuinely tough. It sounds ripe for some code penning if somebody wants to get famous on code pen doing responsive checkout flow. There you go.
Totally. Do it.
But I would there's examples out there for sure. So, and there's more and more as things go on. So, I would keep looking.
So we did our sponsor, and Brian, let's do one more. I'm trying to pick one that would be interesting. So that one's e-commerce performance. Yeah, let's get, well, maybe we'll do two. Nobody's in a rush, are we? You have to work today, David? Probably.
I'm good. I'm here all day.
Yeah. Okay. This is just keeping me away from Christmas cookies, so.
Frank Spin asks, I have a quick question about WordPress performance. To register my theme styles and scripts, I use the functions WP enqueue script, WP register script, and then WP register style and WP enqueue style. For some post type specific styles and scripts, I use the WordPress logic is post type archive and post type functions to check the current post type and then load the scripts only when needed. Do you think this is a good tactic, or is it better just to load all the styles and scripts and minify them? So presumably on Frank's site, there's some different areas of the site, some different post types, which, you know, maybe just for the sake of discussion and being able to picture this for ourselves, we'll say maybe he's got a site about movies and he's got a blog about movies. So when you're reading a blog post, you can just read about, it just looks like a blog post. But then if you click the title of a movie name, perhaps there's a post type of movie where it has different styling and different scripts that need to be shown because it just looks totally different. It's like an IMDb or something like that that needs a whole different set of CSS and scripts. Is it better for him to load all everything on every page, or is it better to use that logic and kind of split up the scripts and styles depending on what page he's on?
Chris, I think you and I argued about something like this.
Possibly.
Over lunch.
We tend to argue about things.
At the wonderful Cooper's restaurant in Madison, Wisconsin.
Well, I mean, how can there be a shout out? Cooper's! How can there be an answer to this?
Well, my answer to that is to never load more than what you need. So you create your stuff modularly and you import them as needed.
Sure. That would be one philosophical way to approach this. Which is fine, I think. I mean, I certainly do that. For example, if you take this in the example of CSS Tricks, and then you go to css-tricks.com/lodge, for example, the lodge has a totally unique look to it. There's different stuff going on in the lodge that goes on anywhere else on the site, and I do exactly that. I have a CSS file that's just for the lodge, and it gets added to that page so that when you're anywhere else on the site, you don't get that CSS file. You don't need it, so you don't get it. So that would fall into David's philosophy of not getting it. The reverse philosophy is, let's say that Lodge CSS file was 20 lines of code. Now on the Lodge, you're downloading this extra, there's an extra request that has to happen. Whereas just throwing it in the global style sheet, it's already there, it's already cached, it's one less HTTP request. So there's a gray area of this being a difficult thing to answer, and you just kind of have to use a lot of your kind of best judgment, I guess, on some things like this.
Yeah, I agree with that point as well. I guess you just need to use your best judgment depending on how much extra
stuff
it would be adding to one file. Yeah.
Yeah. And it gets deeper than, I mean, let's say this is, it takes it to a whole another level of really deep structure. Do you have, I mean, how many CSS files is too many on a page? I generally have this thing where I think three is just about as many CSS files as you should ever load on a page, but that's, you know, I understand that's a little arbitrary, but I think once you're getting up into five and stuff, you're like, dude, you're going to need to start concatenating some of this or making different decisions. There is kind of a ceiling level of how much CSS any kind of page on the internet really needs. You know, I understand there's way crazy edge cases of whether you're designing a storybook that is all animated and flows through the universe or something that needs some ridiculous amount of CSS. But the vast majority of websites on the internet, they don't need that much CSS, you know? You're not in this area of needing to load 200K of CSS. It's just not JavaScript, on the other hand, it's a little more complex to make statements like that. But CSS is just, it ain't that bad, guys.
Yeah, I'm gonna get absolute for you guys. I'm gonna have an absolute. If it's like a core feature to your site or product, it should be in your CSS. Like if your user is designed to get into this feature, like it needs to be in there immediately. If it's just kind of some extra thing, that's an extra style sheet. Boom. That's my official position.
I think the last time we argued about it, it was about kind of, you know, not loading something like jQuery when you don't need it because you don't need all the functions and stuff that it provides. It would be better to load, you know, small modular bits of jQuery, just what you need. And, you know, and I think I was just kind of saying, oh, dude, screw it, whatever. Just get the
library. Modularity.
Yeah, kind of. Not, you know, only when it has to do with a library that's so small anyways, and just use the freaking library and shut up. Anyway, that was probably the argument. But
I think you actually said that, too. Just use it.
The other part of this question is about how he enqueues every single style. He uses WP enqueue script everywhere. And I think it's not exactly more modern, but I've avoided doing that. I wonder if I should switch over to using that. I have in my header.php file from usually the WordPress sites I work on, I just put a bunch of logic up in it that says, like, you know, if it's this page, then I just put a link tag and link to that CSS file that I need for it. And if it's this other page, then link to this. And I'm starting to think that's a little, I don't know, it's just confusing. It's just muddying up my views, I guess. I should move that stuff to a plugin or the functions.php file, get the logic and stuff, and just enqueue and register styles. Behind. I'm behind on my WordPress abilities.
That makes sense. I think if you need to add special logic to either include or not include something, maybe not putting it in the header would be the best idea.
Yeah, because WordPress already does a good job of not muddying up the views too bad. I mean, the only logic they have in views generally is the loop. Yeah. And it's not even that logic-y, really. You usually don't have to put any. It's only if you want to alter the loop, which you could do elsewhere. So, for a PHP app, it does a pretty good job of keeping views clean. Anyway, that's it, maybe.
Yeah, that's a good one. I was going to say the chat room is doing really good, and I'll leave you guys with a joke. A web designer walks into a bar, then leaves immediately because he can't stand the table layout. But that one was from Charlotte Dan in the chat room. Thanks. There's also another one, but I'm going to save it. It's really good. Josh Long really doing well there.
Good.
So anyhow, there you go. That's all I got. David, thank you so much for coming on the show. We really appreciate you taking time out of your holiday season here. How can people find you on the internet, give you money, and give your blog the Shop Talk Show bump?
Sure. So my blog is davidwalsh.name. My Twitter is davidwalshblog. And on GitHub, I am Darkwing. So you can find out what projects I'm involved in with Mozilla and personally.
Very cool. Awesome. And that works out great. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Tuning in live, you guys in the chat room were really good today. Extra credit for you guys because it's kind of a slow day. But yeah, rate us up in iTunes. Click the 5-star button and then follow us on Twitter at Shop Talk Show. We have t-shirts available over at shoptalkshow.com/t-shirts. And Chris, do you have anything else you'd like to add?
All I really have left to say is shoptalkshow.com.